Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. Today's podcast, originally recorded in 1991, is with economists Keith Bush, Ben Slay, and John Tedstrom discussing how to introduce a market economy in nations that have had a totalitarian command economy. We hope you enjoy today's podcast, and don't forget to subscribe to get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
Well, I mean, the conversation today is focused on privatization, but that's really part of a much larger process that's going on throughout the world. And you know, the three of us are concerned most strongly with the process of transformation in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union. The experiences in what we used to call Eastern Europe and what we used to call the Soviet Union are very different. Hungary has a couple decades of experience with serious reform. Poland got a much later start, but in many ways is leading the path. The Soviet Union is splitting up, and we have different ideas about privatization in Russia, Ukraine, Belarus, and not to mention Central Asia and the Baltics. Keith, you recently chaired a session here at Radio Liberty, Radio for Europe, on privatization. What were some of the key points that came out of that session?
I think there was general agreement that the countries of the Soviet Union, or the former Soviet Union, and the countries of Eastern Europe are certainly agreed that they have to privatize. The debate within the Soviet Union is how to do so. They really just at the beginning of it, whereas in Eastern Europe they've started on the process and they've had different experiences, and Ben will be the best person to talk, I think, to the progress and the lack of progress they've made. There are three distinct schools of thought we can go into on how to privatize. There's a large body of thought in the East and in the West that you should give away the former state property on various grounds. There's one that says no, on no account give it away, people must earn it, people must buy this. And there's the third score, inevitably, which says let's have a little bit of each, but we can go into this during the discussion.
Mm-hmm. Ben, what is privatization?
Very good question. Different people understand privatization in different ways, of course. Some people understand it to mean simply the task of transferring ownership of state-owned property to private individuals or institutions. Others see it as a more broad-based process that includes also the development of those private firms which existed even during the command economy phase, because even in the worst eras of Stalinism in the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, you had private enterprise functioning in some way or another, sometimes legal, sometimes not, certainly with deformities, but nonetheless, there always was a private sector of sorts. So privatization is also understood to mean, or can be understood to mean, the process of developing this sector, the indigenous private sector, one might say. And even more broadly, one can think of privatization as developing a culture for market economy, institutions for market economy, for example, creating a stock market, creating a legal system that guarantees that contracts won't be infringed upon, or when they're broken, there are legal means to address that, and creating regulatory institutions to control a stock market, to control the appearance of privately owned monopolies, that sort of thing. So privatization can be understood in a very broad way as well.
One of the things that strikes me about the differences between Eastern Europe and the Soviet, or let's even be more specific, the Russian experience, is that the Poles seem to have taken very much of a top-down approach to privatization. The Soviets, and the Russians in particular, have been very reluctant to do so, to follow into that. Yeltsin has issued a new plan for reform that includes privatization, but up until now, we have seen a degree of what we might call a private economy develop in Russia, in the Soviet Union, going back, beginning perhaps as far back as mid-1987 with the first draft law on cooperatives. What's the difference? And you know much more about the East European experience as a top-down, let's plan privatization. And Keith, you studied the Yeltsin program for reform from the top down. What do each of you see as kind of the distinguishing characteristics of the different processes?
Well, I think the main feature of the Yeltsin program is its ambitious time schedule, because he is aiming to privatize a very large slew of smaller, medium-sized enterprises within months. He's also aims to privatize housing, retail trade outlets, also within months, the kind of thing that's taken some of the East European countries several years and they're not finished yet. So I think he's tremendously ambitious. He's driving away. Some of his advisors don't agree with him. They come out publicly and say this, but wait a minute, we must have this precondition, that precondition, we must have stabilization of the situation. But he is of the opinion, and he may well be right, that gradualism is self-defeating, and he's pushing ahead at great speed, and we wish him the best of luck there.
Well, I would quibble a little bit with the characterization of Eastern European privatization being a sort of top-down, controlled, planned privatization, in a sense. That's sort of what's happened in the last year or so in Poland and Hungary. But that's, in itself, is only a relatively recent development, and itself reflects dissatisfaction, one might say, with more grassroots type of privatization that happened beforehand. Really, the sort of state-controlled privatization in Eastern Europe and Poland and Hungary in particular, Czechoslovakia as well, I would say here, a reaction to the kind of privatization that happened before, namely spontaneous privatization, where in the last days, the last years of the communist rule, the communists in these countries, seeing what was coming, tried to transfer their political elite status into economic elite status by becoming owners in either a legal or a real sense, becoming owners of the state firms. And so what you began to see when the communists are losing power is that the old communist officials end up being the owners of what in theory should still be state-owned firms. And there was a tremendous backlash on the part of the population against the old nomenklatura that ran the system into the ground and exploited the people, such was the feeling, suddenly becoming the new capitalists, becoming the new ruling class in a different type of social system. And so, I mean, this really was the lesson of, in a sense, 1988, 1989, 1990 in Poland and Hungary, certainly. And so then what you see are privatization laws being passed, creating privatization ministries to control the process from the top down. It's not at all clear how successful this is being so far, but it doesn't recommend, it doesn't represent a sort of a priori desire that we think it can work better this way and this is what we have to do. Rather, it reflects the fact that the previous type of privatization was considered to be politically unacceptable by the electorates, by the societies. And we may see other phases of privatization emerging after this sort of attempt to have privatization ministries controlling the process, which have really slowed things down and haven't really effectively transferred ownership of state property to private actors in the way that was anticipated. That would be my guess, at least.
It strikes me that one of the experiences that Eastern Europe did not go through that the Soviets or former Soviets are struggling with right now is this problem of the old traditional system breaking down, falling apart, disintegrating, with nothing coming in to take its place to fill the vacuum. Am I right in thinking that that process did not happen to a large degree in Eastern Europe?
Well, it did in some places. Yeah. It didn't in others. I mean, if you look again at Poland and Hungary, which are sort of the two leading cases of the development of the private sector, you see in the space of 2 or 3 years, very large increases in the size of the private sector relative to the rest of the economy. There was something to fill the gap. But if you look at a country like Romania or Albania, where there was such tight control of all facets of individuals' lives, not just economic, but everything, prior to 1989, 1990, there is no private sector to speak of that can step in to take fill that vacuum. Or what private sector there was simply the black market, which was incredibly corrupt, oftentimes dominated by the same political authorities that were running the country and were enriching themselves through the sort of the back door at the same time. And so the kind of private activity you see arising here leaves much to be desired. I mean, it's hard to do well by doing good in these societies, and especially in some of the more controlled ones under the communist leadership. So yes, you can talk about private sector fill in the gap in some places, but not in others, I would say.
But as far as the collapse of the system, it seemed to me that Hungary and Poland and Czechoslovakia did not go through this type of disintegration of the traditional supply networks, the planning system, etc., that the Soviets are going through right now and have been going through over the course of the last 2 years.
Again, I find it a little bit more complicated. Certainly an economy like Czechoslovakia or Hungary was in fairly good shape in the sense of having stable microeconomic relationships prior to the collapse of the communist political system. Poland, on the other hand, was a total mess in 1989. Right. Hyperinflation, foreign debt growing out of control. Same thing with Yugoslavia and continuing for this matter. So again, it depends on really which country you're talking about it and what time frame. I would agree, however, that the scale of disorganization and chaos in the former Soviet economy far exceeds any of those cases, with the possible exception of Yugoslavia today, for obvious reasons, the civil war there.
I mean, the reason I was asking, and maybe you have some more thoughts on this, Keith, is that it seems to me that privatization, where it has taken place in the Soviet region, has been privatization by default in most cases. It's been an effort on the part of people at the grassroots level to fill the vacuum, as it were, of the former state structure that used to exist that doesn't function anymore. We see that even in the defense industries, the idea of attaching cooperatives to former defense plants that, of course, were secret and very closed, but now they are toying with the idea, and in some cases actually experimenting with it, of privatizing these plants. And also these plants are forming their own independent supply linkages and trade relationships among themselves and with their other suppliers outside of the traditional state system. How do you feel about this idea of privatization by default and the idea of that private sector of the economy growing out of that chaos?
Can I shift to something perhaps related to something to which Ben referred a little earlier, this idea of the old nomenklatura, the party elite, the party cadres, muscling in on taking on this privatization and becoming the new privilegientia, the privileged classes, because one could argue that these are the trained cadres, these are managers, these people have been through higher education, they're capable people, because you don't necessarily survive the communist system unless you got elbows and can get ahead, and you've got to be pretty ruthless too. So in a way you could say, well, these are the people to take over the new plants, the new enterprises, take over the new stores. But as Ben said, there's a great deal of resentment amongst the population who've seen what they see the Communist Party sucking away, responsible for this terrible economic condition which they're now in, and they're the beneficiaries that are the party officials. So there is that process happening also in the Soviet Union, and particularly amongst the Communist Party of the Soviet Union officials, who have ferreted away quite a bit of wealth or sent some wealth abroad. Mm-hmm. But this is presently going on in the Soviet Union.
I would add, if I may, a point to that. There has, of course, been a tremendous reaction against spontaneous privatization in these countries. There was quite a reaction against it in the Western press and on the part of sort of Western observers, scholarly as well as press, about spontaneous privatization. But I must say that on the basis of what I have seen in Poland and Hungary, even when you establish a ministry for privatization to control the process, the ministry slows down privatization without really cleaning it up. New sorts of types of corruption appear, where oftentimes you hear stories about officials from the privatization ministry suddenly getting large chunks of stock in the firms that are being privatized, or the consulting firms that are performing the valuation of the assets to be sold, because in order to sell a piece of property, you have to know how much it's worth, and they get consulting firms to estimate that. Well, those consulting firms end up with a piece of the shares too. So it seems to me that, in effect, we're always going to have some amount of corruption in these societies. It's inevitable, given where they came from and what their historical experience has been. And so from a sort of rational point of view, it's not clear to me that preventing corruption in the privatization process is a sort of viable justification for creating a giant bureaucracy to slow it down. Now, of course, it's fundamentally a political question of what the societies are willing to tolerate and how this issue is dealt with in the political arena by political parties. But I suspect that in the long run, when all is said and done, you know, we're going to have one form of spontaneous privatization, that is to say, privatization from the bottom up, not really controlled by the state for all of its intentions and bureaucracies. This is what we're going to end up seeing, I suspect.
And could I say, it also points out the need for Western participation. This doesn't cost very much to send in accountants, bankers and so forth, and the Western institutions are doing this. It's very important they have Western-trained accountants working with their Soviet or East European counterparts. And it's also very important that the whole process is under the glare of publicity. It must be open. Otherwise, you're going to get the kind of sweetheart deals for which the Hungarians have got a bad name up to now. And this is part of the thing that the radios, I think, are advocating very much. And as I say, it doesn't cost very much. We're not talking about many billions of dollars. We're talking about a few million dollars to have teams of accountants right there in situ until they've trained up their own people.
One of the issues that's connected with that is the issue of the value of these assets and the fact that in the Soviet economy, at least, these enterprises that are scheduled to be privatized or maybe scheduled to be privatized are really, in a sense, multinationals. Parts of them are located in one republic, parts in another. The ministries are not located just within one republic. As the Soviet Union disintegrates politically, I think it's going to be a terrible problem in determining to what extent Ukraine has a stake in a particular ministry and to what extent Russia does, etc. Do you see any progress or any even discussion on that front?
Well, I think it underlines the importance of having a common economic space. It underlines the importance of having a currency or currencies that are somehow compatible. And I think that if Yeltsin's program works, that people have to follow Russia's lead and the lead of the newly formed Commonwealth in having a currency that works throughout that space. I'm all in favor of his big bang approach on prices. Once you free prices, after a certain time when things settle down a bit, then you'll have prices which mean something, and then you'll be able to start putting prices on property to sell. At the moment, it would be completely artificial. And that these prices must also be valid for people in Ukraine, in Belarus, other republics that choose to join, and they must also be meaningful for Western investors. That's a very different aspect. I've interviewed several Western specialists on the whole subject of privatization, and in most respects, they agree very much with their Soviet colleagues and the Soviet debate that I followed. The only difference being there is a very strong xenophobic trend in the Soviet debate. And economists who are quite liberal in other respects, and I shan't name names, are very xenophobic in their reluctance to let the Western into their market, to the Western investors in the market and buying up property. Very strong, unfortunately. Mm-hmm.
What about cross-country privatization in the sense of a Ukrainian, for example, buying an enterprise or Ukrainian consortium buying an enterprise in the Russian Republic?
Well, this will work if they all have currencies based on one single, on the Russian ruble or chervones or whatever they come up with.
But you don't see the political, the xenophobia coming into that?
Not between republics.
I would just add on that point, if I may, that I think I might disagree with you, Keith, but not that I know quite as much about it. But I mean, I think one can already find examples in the Soviet press of, for example, ethnic Russians trying to get rid of economic organizations on their territory that originate in a different republic and are employed and are staffed by members of a different nationality who are noticeably different.
That's not for economic reasons, probably. More for...
Well, but whatever the reasons are, I mean, the same sort of reasons why Americans don't like Japanese firms buying up Hollywood and whatever those animal spirits come from, I suspect they'll manifest themselves in the Soviet case as well. You can find examples in Eastern Europe as well, where there are tremendous fears of, you know, the Germans coming in and, you know, doing what they weren't able to do or weren't able to finish during the Second World War. That's not so much an inter-Eastern European thing. Although, for example, with the collapse of Yugoslavia, if and when the fighting stops, there's going to be issues about Croats buying shares of Serbian property, and there's going to be the same sort of issues in Czechoslovakia when the Slovaks and the Czechs form their own independent countries, as they're now apparently going to do. Will the Slovaks be willing to let Czechs buy property in their firm? So I think that this is a very important issue, and it's not just limited to the Soviet Union. And the fact that it hasn't really happened yet doesn't mean it won't be a big problem in the future. That would be my impression.
That's maybe right.
In fact, if I could pursue this idea a little bit further, this raises, to my mind, the whole question of who should be allowed to become the owners of the state property. Because my feeling is that 80% of the controversy about privatization in this part of the world revolves around that question. And the fact is that virtually every possible buyer can be disqualified on the basis of some sort of political or social feelings that are fairly widespread in the region. You know, can't have foreigners for xenophobic reasons, as you pointed out, Keith. We can't have the old managers because they're affiliated with the Communist Party, discredited. We can't have the workers because they don't know anything about running firms. They instead grew up in an environment where they were guaranteed a job and didn't work very hard and aren't entrepreneurial at all. How about the former owners who used to own the firms? That's another possibility. Well, a lot of them, you can say, were compromised by collaborating with the Germans during the war, or spent 20 or 30 years abroad and don't understand the situation in their home country now. And then you can say, well, let's give the property away to everyone, you know, the sort of universal distribution approach, but it's not clear that everyone being the owner is any different from socialism. Or if you really want to do that, you have to take a lot of other steps as well. So this to me is a big part of why privatization is turning out to be so difficult too. There's no politically and economically both acceptable group of people to become the owners.
Could I go into this debate? No. Either giving it away or selling it. And the people who advocate, and these are Western specialists and Western observers, they also, this is the Soviet debate, they argue that the wealth was created by the people on the grounds of equity. It must be given back to them. It is there. They've earned it through years of toil and deprivation. And that's a very, I think, very sound point. They say this is an historic opportunity to create capitalism, that everybody would have certain amount of the commonwealth, and it wouldn't then all go to the privilegienza, to the former nomenclatura. It would go to all the people. They suggest that if you give away the state property, this makes the reform process irreversible, and that's a very good point too. You can't go back. Couldn't put the egg together again. They also suggest that it would give political support to the economic reform process in the same way the analogy was drawn with Henry VIII. He confiscated the wealth of the monasteries, distributed amongst some of his trusted nobles, and gained thereby a great deal of political support. And this would give economic reform the support it doesn't presently have. People are very, very apprehensive, very nervous, especially in the Soviet Union, about what economic reform will bring. They think it's necessary to have widespread privatization, which you can only get through giving it away. There's not many people who have that much liquid savings, in order to break the state stranglehold on the economy. And this is certainly a factor after so many decades of communist rule in the Soviet Union.
It seems to me, if I could break in at this point, though, that it's worth making a distinction between privatizing productive and non-productive assets, namely housing. That's a big issue.
Yeah.
And much more important, if we're going to distribute this property equally to everyone, I think that there's a major difference between giving them ownership and title to their own apartment or house, and to giving them a certain amount of shares in some enterprise that they don't know, they don't have any interest in other than these shares, they don't have any confidence in. It seems to me that that's a very false way of privatization of productive assets.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Just the issuance of shares or, you know, something like that. But it seems to me also, on the other hand, that this idea of housing and land that people have lived on, have paid some rent on or something for many years, in the democratic or populist way that you suggested, is something that could be very beneficial. Because after all, I mean, a market, if this is really privatized, a market will develop, even if it's not in the first round. If we privatize it administratively, a market will develop in the second round. And at that point, then, prices, values of these non-productive type of assets can be determined more accurately, and they can be traded back and forth.
Mm-hmm. I think it's very strong support for tenants to be given title to their own housing up to a certain limit, and above there, those who happen to have 50 square meters instead of those who have to huddle in 30 square meters would probably have to pay a tax on the excess amount of meters. That's fair enough, I think. Before this would take place, though, it would make sense to raise the rents to an economic level, because otherwise, if you're going to ask people to buy the housing, they say, why should I buy it? I live here for a pittance. I live here for a few rubles a month. I don't have to worry about the upkeep. Why should I cough up 50,000 rubles for this? So once they've made rents economic level, then I think the argument would be much, much more clear. Mm-hmm. And certainly the answer, that the same is true for those who've been working the land. They should be given title to a certain amount of land. People have been working on a farm or on private plots for quite a long time.
Well, if I could pick up the idea of the free distribution of the productive assets, as you referred to them, the idea of let's distribute shares in a state-owned factories, which in some sense is the crux of the privatization problem. I think it's, while it may be very useful in some sense to say this is the most just approach, and it obviously is the most just approach in a sense, it's very important nonetheless to look at the problems that have already developed in the countries that have tried this. These problems don't mean that it's a hopeless approach, and perhaps, you know, some kind of good methods can be worked out using the universal distribution of state assets. But if you look at Czechoslovakia and Poland, where this is sort of the official policy for much of the privatization effort, there are all kinds of problems, and it's just not working out very well at all. In Czechoslovakia, very briefly, in effect, what they've done is to give everyone the right to purchase booklets of coupons for a nominal fee, and they can exchange their coupons for stock in certain firms, the firms they choose. But instead of being a direct exchange, they have to, in effect, bid for the stock by allocating a certain amount of points that are implicit in the coupon booklet. There's, I believe, 1,000 points. So you can say, well, I really want to become a shareholder of this one firm, and so I will take 800 of my 1,000 points and use them to bid for shares in this firm. That's the way the Czechs are doing this. Now, this raises the question of who determines which points bid by which individuals actually become stock in which firm. Mm-hmm. And the Czechs and the Slovaks, apparently both of them, are going to throw this all into a computer. And the computer is going to solve this question, which raises a number of issues. If computers could really do this, we mm-hmm. wouldn't need Wall Street, that sort of thing. Maybe it can work, but there's reason to doubt. In Poland, they've gone another step. They've created giant mutual funds, or they say they're going to create giant mutual funds. They haven't done it yet, whereby individuals would become not the owners of the firms directly, the firms to be privatized, but rather would become owners of mutual funds, that is to say, large groupings of stock, which in turn would exercise the functions of ownership, be owners in effect for the firms.
Including control.
Management. Right. And they will be rated every year.
And they're supposed to be rated every year, and the incentives, the managers of the mutual funds are supposed to be linked to the growth in the value of the assets of the firms that they are managing or owning or whatever you want to call it. And this too has presented a number of terrible problems and have caused the program to be slowed down dramatically. There have been fears that these mutual funds, since they're going to be created by the government, are going to become government bureaucracies. What will happen if a mutual fund is about to fail because it makes bad decisions? If it fails, since there's a small number of them, each fund is large and has a large share of the economy's capital. Is the government going to let this fund go under? You know, did the United States government let the Continental Illinois Bank or Penn Station go under or Chrysler go under? No, it didn't. So the Polish government is probably unlikely to let this fund go under as well. Well, then how likely are funds really to exercise good judgment in the use of their resources, knowing that they're going to get bailed out? It's socialism all over again. At least that's the kind of problem you see.
And but what is the feasible alternative to mutual?
Well, that's the question. I ultimately think that we're going to have some sort of spontaneous privatization. That's what's going to come out of all of this. But your point is very well taken, that there's no use simply describing the problems of a given approach without thinking about the problems of the alternative approaches, which may be work. Nonetheless, I simply want to bring the point up that the most just, in some sense, approach, and what seems to be the most appealing and simplest also, really isn't that simple or appealing at all when you start to look at the details, the brass tacks of how it's going to work.
It seems to me I'm much more concerned about the Polish approach because it seems to me that the prospects for a market in private property and these productive assets, namely stocks, you know, through these mutual funds, the prospects for a market like that developing is very slim for the reasons that you suggest. On the other hand, in Czechoslovakia, even if this computer makes an imperfect match between buyer and what's being bought, again, in the second round, you know, if a market does develop, the market will take care of those problems and correct or work towards correcting one of those mistakes or some of those mistakes. And to me, I think that just like in the Soviet case, underscores the importance of a market system, market mechanisms going along with privatization. It seems to me to be of little use to have the Polish solution of these mutual funds where they risk becoming the state, you know, part of the old state system or replicating a lot of the characteristics of the old state system where there won't be a market. It seems to me that the market has to be underlying the whole private sector and the development of that sector, or else any of these schemes for privatization are bound to fail because they're always going to be imperfect. The imperfections are going to lead to political and social opposition, and perhaps, you know, especially in Russia where people are very sensitive to the idea of that, it could really set the reform process back.
Mm-hmm. This, I think, is one of the promising aspects of the Yeltsin program, which was outlined at the end of October and which is now being put in that, again, he eschews gradualism and he doesn't say, as many of his predecessors of Rishkov plan or the Balkan plan, that first we must stabilize, use a dirigist mechanism to stabilize the economy, shall we say 1 or 2 or 3 years, and then we'll proceed. Yeltsin has accepted, and this is Gaidar's concept, that you must launch all of these aspects of privatization and conversion to market economy all at the same time. They'll go at different speeds, but they all must be done at once, which he's trying to do, in fact.
There's a point that you raised earlier about privatization and the political dimensions of that, namely, you know, what Henry VIII did, the idea of Gorbachev becoming popular once he privatizes is becoming even more popular.
Not Gorbachev.
Or Yeltsin. Definitely. Yeah, but that leads to my question for you, and that is, had Gorbachev privatized land or housing 2 years ago, would he still be the president of a viable political and economic state today?
I think it was such anathema to him that he had to swallow and close his eyes before he pronounced the word. The selling of land is so, he just couldn't buy that. That's one of the things he just couldn't, hardly couldn't jump. Yeah. And I just cannot conceive that he would have. Mm-hmm. Allowed the privatization of land. He has spoken up against it and the selling of land so much, so often, that he's convinced of that. So I don't, it's so hypothetical, mm-hmm. I don't think it's worth speculating
on that point, if I may add something. Although the proponents of universal distribution of ownership in Poland and Czechoslovakia say this will get everybody involved, it will increase political support for the idea of privatization, the public opinion data on this does not support those beliefs. It doesn't necessarily contradict them, but you can't find, you know, people saying in Poland, oh, I feel so much better about myself because I'm going to become part ownership of a mutual fund, part right. owner of a mutual fund. Right. In fact, there's some data that says people really don't care, they don't understand, and just think it's something that the government is doing that probably affects them in some indirect way, but they don't have time to worry about it.
But is that it's public relations. They've done such a bad job explaining it.
Yeah, I mean, does that just underscore the importance of making this whole process transparent, obvious? And it's not just that, and perhaps here again, it's more important to be owner of my house than it is to be owner of shares in a mutual fund or some coupons that maybe will give me some stake in some enterprise somewhere after the computer runs through its calculations. I mean, for example, in the Baltic states, public opinion polls show that they are strongly behind, much more so than in other parts of the former Soviet region, strongly behind privatization and marketization. And I think that we'll see a movement on that score a lot more rapidly than we will on the rest of the former USSR.
If you turn over housing to the residents, what happens to the 30-odd million families that are still having to live in communal apartments or dormitories on waiting lists?
What would happen to them in any event?
Well, you've got to start the housing market sometime.
Yeah, that seems to me to be a separate issue.
I don't necessarily believe in that. I just say this is raised as an issue.
Yeah, but that's going to be an issue in any event.
Yeah.
I think that I'm very much in the camp, in the school of thought that you mentioned, that if privatization quickly, universally, especially for housing and land, I think that will solidify reformists in political positions now and will make the process of reform virtually irreversible.
Now, just a footnote, the Yeltsin program does not envisage the easy sale of land. It hasn't spelled it out yet. That particular portion has not been spelled out, and it seems they're going for long-term leasing of some kind, but not the open sale of land. They're so worried about speculators moving in, buying up land, foreigners moving in, buying up large tracts of land. It's a tremendous obstacle there.
On this point, the Eastern European experience with the selling of land or the reprivatization of land also is somewhat problematic, because if you look at countries like Hungary or Czechoslovakia, which had collectivized agriculture, that is to say that land was taken away from the peasants and combined into large state and collective farms by the communists, it's not clear what the right thing to do is, because if you simply divide up those farms, the big farms, and give everybody their own little plot, you're probably going to have decreases and perhaps significant decreases in agricultural production here, because the farms are, all the capital, the tractors, everything is not set up for lots of little farms, but a few big farms. It's a sad irony, but nonetheless, economic rationality, in a sense, argues for not returning all the land to whoever was the previous owner. And there's some other problems too. Land, there weren't really markets for land in these countries, just like there weren't markets for capital, because everything was owned by the state. So it's hard to sell things or distribute things to private individuals when there's no market to set a price, to set a value on these things. And the reason there's no market is because all of these things are still owned by the state, in effect. So we've got a catch-22 here.
Mm-hmm.
This applies to land, it applies to capital and many other types of properties as well. And even as a final note, I would say, even if you look at Poland, a country with, generally speaking, the private agricultural sector, after 1956, agriculture was decollectivized in Poland. Even there, the market for land is very messed up in a lot of ways. It doesn't work very well in some important ways. And the kinds of government regulations that have been established in the last year or two to start to privatize those state farms that do exist in Poland have, in a sense, distorted the market even more. So there's no real good answer, it seems, on how to distribute land, how to break up the big farms to be found in any of these countries. I don't blame Yeltsin for not having a good answer here.
Mm-hmm.
To go back to your point about people not all that proud of owning mutual funds, it doesn't really, you know, public opinion surveys have shown that they doesn't necessarily change their views or their behavior. There is a point to say, well, why should the ordinary Soviet citizen who hasn't had all that much in his savings deposit, why should he risk his hard-earned money on buying shares in factories which are hopelessly obsolete, which are completely uncompetitive? If ever they had to face foreign competition, they are polluting, they're badly run, and the ordinary Soviet citizen is very risk-averse. He doesn't want to speculate with his hard-earned gains, especially when in a year last year, for example, when the Japanese stock market lost half its value.
Want more episodes like this? Don't forget to subscribe and get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.